I remembered my cup of tea this time, you know. It's so far so good. My name's Leslie Gray. I'm an alcoholic, and thank you all for being here. I'm really happy to see some different faces here tonight. Because the nature of this meeting is that so I'm qualified as an alcoholic to speak anywhere, and to speak at this meeting you need to have 30 years continuous sobriety. I say this every week, but each one of these discs stand alone. So I had my last drink February 23rd, 1981, so I hit that benchmark established for speaking in this meeting. And at this point, I have my library with me again, because I prepare for each one of these, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity because it sends me back to the materials that I should make more frequent and regular use of, but whatever reason gets you there is good. But I want to start real quick with step seven, and that's humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. And I just want to begin kind of quickly with As Bill Sees It, again, one of my favorite books. And this is from a Bill Wilson letter, 1959. And the statement is, AA is no success story in the ordinary sense of the word. It is a story of suffering transmuted under grace into spiritual progress. And step seven is sure part of that. So, you know, just kind of to begin at this, up to this point, we're halfway through, but we're starting our second level with surrendering, at least as I started to think about it and read the material and, you know, put it together. You know, the steps are beautifully conceived and presented. And anyway, so to this point, we had our first level of admission, which is step one, you know, to admit we're powerless over alcohol. And then our first level of willingness, step two, you know, become willing to concede a power greater than ourselves, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And then our first level of surrender at step three, making a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And then we get to our first level of action to start to admit and look at and take an honest evaluation of our character, or where we went wrong, our defects, and those things that were kind of, for me, and many of us, but for me, those things that immediately surrounded my drinking and that were real directly tied up in my drinking. And so that's a first level of looking at me and the person I was aside from my drink. So now with step six and step seven, we're starting to move, as I see it anyway, into the next level of surrender and willingness and acceptance. And it's related to my defects and my issues and my problems and all those things that were wrong with me that was underlying my drinking. And in fact, all that bad stuff, that unlovely character aspects that survived my getting sober, you know, that was still there even though I didn't take a drink. So there was a lot, it survived my physical abstinence from drinking, let's say, you know, not those things that were still there. So I was driving myself crazy about this quote. And I'm going to tell you, this is a part of how it works. And this is why we carry on and do step six and seven and continue to work. Because what the book tells us is this. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And I know I was driving everyone crazy with this last week because I couldn't think of what it was. And then, it working with others, it talks about After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. So the kind of, you know, those two things for me kind of brings home once again, there is more wrong with me than just drinking. And just stopping drinking doesn't solve everything or what's wrong with me. So here we go into step six and step seven. So again, it becomes a starting to take an honest look of what's wrong with me, what's wrong with my character. It really is another level of willingness. And here's where we start to set up the rest of our life going forward. How are we going to live comfortable? How am I going to live comfortable without my medicine? That means I have to fix some things, or I have to let God fix some things. And so all this reading and all this living, six and seven really starts to be about living life as a sober, mature adult in keeping with God's will. Now, that's easy to say, but that's really quite a tall order. So we go to step seven, where we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. And so I go then to, you know, the big book is, again, real skimpy on working step seven and working step six. It's about half a page. It's like two paragraphs, and it's kind of, well, here we are, and let's get willing, and then we say this prayer. And if you don't know the seven-step prayer, I'm going to read it to you because it's a nice prayer, and I hope I, you know, attend to this. But the book talks about that we have defects we hold on to, we ask God to help us be willing. But the seven-step prayer is, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen." Now, I thought that meant I had to be like wonderful all at once, and it was a great relief to me to be told by my sponsor that that meant that was the defects that were getting in God's way of me being useful, or getting in my way of being useful to people around me and to God and His plans. So go into the 12 and 12. It talks about, it talks about our crippling handicap had been a lack of humility. That was certainly true in my case, because we all know, and Bruce will throw in here, that I was very smart and still am, and had, you know, I was young and well educated and not like some of these old bum guys who were at the meetings. And he's, you know how these guys are at this meeting, and they torment you, right? So all in careful care. But anyway, it talks about our crippling handicap had been our lack of humility. Certainly true for me. We lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first. And I certainly did that. It also talked about, and this was important to me, the lack of anchorage to any permanent values, a blindness to true purpose. And as long as we were convinced that we could live exclusively on our own individual strength and intelligence, for just that long was a working faith of a higher power impossible. And, you know, this process is, of course, difficult. So I had to not only say I was letting go, I had to start acting like it. And that's, you know, that's easier said than done. And that's where, you know, some of the work comes in. It talks about, they say this so quickly, I had to, um, I always wanted to escape. The 12 and 12 talks about that. And the thing about these books is no matter when they were written and no matter what style, I've always found them to be true. Like they were looking at me through the pages somehow and putting this down. But it talks about beginning to fear pain less and wanting humility more. And it also, this was important for me, we needn't always be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. It could come quite as much from our voluntary reaching for it as it would come from unremitting suffering, which meant I could maybe just start doing some things. I didn't have to wait, you know? I didn't have to live like a drunk anymore. I didn't have to get pounded into oblivion before I was willing to make a change. And in fact, you know, by putting down the drink, maybe I would start getting a little smarter about those things. Maybe I would start to look around at some better examples of people who were living well, living lives that I would aspire to, that I would hope to put together, and start wondering and asking, how are you doing it? What's different here? What's the difference between you and me? What is it in me that prevents me from doing what it is that you're doing that lets you live successfully? When I was new, this was very common. I've heard this a million times, maybe you have too, of why we do step 6 and step 7, and it goes like this, okay? The man I was drank, the man I was will drink again, I have to change. That's the simple explanation of that. That was universal, and that's true. That's true. In my middle sobriety, and you know, I did a lot of things messed up in sober years without taking a drink. My character defects on full parade, that played itself out a lot in my married life, such as it was, brief as they were. But you know what I found was, without giving a whole lot of detail, let me say this. I would find myself involved in things, doing things, arguing about things, and being a person I didn't like very much. You know, and when those discoveries would come upon me, I had some work to do. I had to remove myself. I had to change myself. I had to find out what was going on. I had to talk to a sponsor. I had to go to a therapist. I did grow up in an alcoholic home. We didn't talk because this was not a lead. I don't deeply get it. Didn't start talking about this. But that left, that itself was created issues that messed up the way I thought, the way I dealt with people, the way I lived. And again, and I distinctly remember arguing with husband number two, and we would have some beauties, and literally thinking, I don't like myself. I don't like acting like this. What is wrong with me? Why can't I stop this? What's the deal here? And I had to leave him and deal with that. And that also, you know, was part of making a change of, you know, fearing the pain less and trusting God more. That, you know, that if I in good faith made a decision because I thought that was what I needed to do for me, for those around me, for my child, for my recovery, I needed to do that. And I needed to, you know, I was told that being afraid was never a good enough reason to not do something I knew I needed to do. And that plays into step 7 a lot. I had to let God take me to a better way of living. I had to grow up. It's the long and short of it. I had to stop being like a bottle baby and medicating all my pain or having a tantrum, because it gets very unbecoming when we're in our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond, that we act like bad kids, you know, stomping and holding our feet and not understanding that I need to be a part of things and contribute and maybe be part of the plan and part of the solution and not always me. And that requires humility, something I didn't have and something I never really wanted and something, you know, I'll be honest at this point, who knows if I have, you know? I don't know, but I know some things I read in books, and you know, I learned by reading books and talking to people together, by reading, talking, and listening and observing and trying and failing and trying and failing again until something worked. But if you're not familiar with the book Drop the Rock, I think it's wonderful, and it gives a more detailed explanation if you're the sort who needs to see that, and I was. And again, I'll mention the Monday night, I can't remember, it's the Washington Road, 7 o'clock, and they read this book and study this book and devote that meeting exclusively to the study of Step 6 and Step 7, which is all about living sober, pretty much, you know, getting rid of stuff. But I want beginning of what this book said, I mean, at page 57, it kind of give the first working definition of humility that made sense. And I didn't find this book till years into my recovery. I wish I'd have known about it sooner. But it talks about, we realize that the people who have stayed abstinent for some time practice a degree of humility that was foreign to them prior to recovery, and that's true. And humility is simply a clear recognition of what and who they are. And that's not always a nice picture, but I have to be honest, or I might as well not be here. They have gotten down to their right size. Humility is understanding that they're worthwhile. It's the middle ground between extremes of grandiosity and intense shame. They have a sincere desire to be and become the best they can be. So, you know, we've learned and read, and I learned and was always told that me, the alcoholic, was the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. And this is kind of the flip side of, I'm worthwhile, but I'm not perfect. I know myself, I got issues, but I'm going to do the best I can and take the lesson. So it means trying to stay right size and remembering we are as humble as we are grateful, and that our humility goes along with our gratitude. This book also talks about, I think it explains it really well, but active surrender. So if I'm sitting here waiting to get wonderful, it ain't gonna happen. I gotta cooperate with the process. And it gives a little list of things about spiritual values and willingness and perspective beyond our addiction. I had to start looking at what was wrong with me besides I drink too much. You know, I didn't like myself. I put things off. I would argue with people. I had a hard time saying if I was wrong. My ego was off to the races, especially after I finished law school. I really thought I was very special then, and indeed, it is an accomplishment. It's a heck of an accomplishment, but really, you know, it's not the only one in the world, and it didn't solve all of my life problems, I can assure you. But the foundation, to work and work at step 7 and to build a successful, happy, and comfortable sobriety is humility, self-acceptance, and self-awareness. I had to start to see who I was, not hate myself for it, and start making the effort to cooperate with God and the program's efforts to change me. And this book asks an important question, so I'm going to just read it to you because I could paraphrase it, but it wouldn't be much. Why does it seem as if it is easier to solve the problems of the world than to solve our own problems? And, guilty here as well. So, when this book talks about when we finally work 6 and 7 and take time to make ourselves a priority, which, like I said, therapy, counselors, step work, program stuff, service. When we take the time, we make a startling discovery. There exists within us at all times a higher power that is the builder of all successes and our comforter during times of trial. Many of us believe that understanding ourselves is in direct relation to our understanding and contact with our higher power. And that's, I think for me, that's true. The more I mean my higher power and my prayer life, my relationship to God as I understand him is very important to me. It is a regular part of my life, bless you, and it, you know, I grew a conscience in recovery. I guess that's God at work. You know, I grew a conscience. I don't feel right when I don't do right, you know, and sometimes it takes me a minute to catch on that I didn't do right, but I don't feel right when I don't do right. And to just, like, let God do what he needs to do, you know, as time, we'll talk about further steps going on, but that was kind of the beginning, you know. And again, when we look, the big book tells us that the whole purpose is to find a power that'll solve our problems for us, and this is more of the same, you know. It just, there's the immediate booze problem, and then there's what's wrong with me problem. So, so it talks about remaining teachable, and sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not, but life is better if I am. And sometimes I forget that, but that's okay. And open-mindedness, you know, for me to say I don't know it all or can't find it all somewhere is not easy, but yes, that's how it has to be. And the last thing I wanted to talk about out of this book, and that made a bunch of sense to me, was that part of humility was service and giving away, you know, helping other people in recovery or being of service to the meetings or to the program somehow. And we all know about giving away to keep it, but this, I'm going to just straight up read this to you because this hit me in between the eyes and it's important to me and I can't say it better. And I think it, for me, I just read this. I went to that meeting a couple of Mondays ago and this is what they were talking about and this kind of got my, you know, but it talks about if humility, being humble, is valuable to us, we must learn to model it and practice humility. So let's start walking the talk, you know. That was what it meant to me in all kind of ways. What other values, spiritual and otherwise, do we hold and how do we demonstrate them? So if I, as I ask myself this, then what am I doing? You know, am I doing what I'm telling people I'm doing? Or how would the world know? If I think this is important, how would the world know that? How am I showing this in my life? Have we examined closely the meaning and purpose of our life? The 6th and 7th step is really asking us what is important to us. And if it is so important, where does it show? We have to get the basics. It's easy to avoid this and think we've worked the steps. And I could dodge this for years, and I have. You know, to come to, who am I? What's my life about? How do I want to live this out? Why did God give me a gift of sobriety? You know, what am I here to do? In a day-to-day mundane, you know, I'm a parent. I raised a child. That's, you know, I valued my child. I guess I like to think if you looked at me, you could see that. I took care of my child. She went to school. She was fed. I cooked, you know, things like that. I taught her things. She knows how to cook too. She, you know, all the, so it, that's just one little example of something that's important to me and how you might look at my life and see that that's true. So what is the value in our life? How is our life giving meaning to others? Are we helping? Are we part of the solution or part of the problem? And how does it show? Always, how does it show? So we're getting past the thinking, cogitating, pondering, and into the real doing and into the real living. How is our higher power part of our life, and how does it show? What value do we give spirituality, and how does it show? And from the answers to these questions comes our ability to share, give, act, and practice humility. So it's, what am I going to do with all of this? You know, I've been given a great gift, and I want to live it and live it well. But I think that was really important. And one of the things I went to a meeting earlier in the day, and we talked about some of this sort of, we talked about gratitude and acceptance. But something that was very dear to me, and I had to start early on and still continue, is adopting the mindset of a victim, which is a little subtle variation on self-pity. But it's like they're victimizing me, they're taking advantage of me, for me to see how something I did or decided or chose, sometimes looking for the easier, softer way, sometimes not even knowing that, but what part did I play in this? And do I really have a choice in this? You know? And for me, at least for that little victim attitude, I find that if I start thinking like I'm a victim, I'm miserable. I'm unhappy, I snap at you, I'm a martyr, and it's terrible. If I can find, with God's help, acknowledge what's my part in things, do I really have a choice? Would I rather feel like a victim rather than take the effort to correct what's in front of me to correct? And sometimes that's the answer. Which is sometimes where, like, those husbands came in, It's like, it's going to be a lot of work to uproot myself and move and, change and figure out different ways to do things. And now I have to shovel the snow myself. And, after my second divorce, I bought a little house. And I would mow the lawn myself. And I felt very empowered, but I remember, doing a lot of those things, but I remember snipping branches off of the trees, and I got one of those long extension things that snip off, and the men across my neighborhood, these dear guys, they would sit and they would drink beer and they would watch me do this and laugh, and I just think, you can imagine what I think. I'm not going to put this on recording of what I thought they could do with themselves, and why wouldn't they help me instead of sitting there making sport and watching me struggle under this thing? So I have a choice, do I feel like a victim, or do I just forget about what they're doing and keep doing what I need to do? So, that's one example, and there's many, and that's one defect of many that's real obvious. That victim attitude, the victim stance, has never been good to me, and it's provided me with a lot of excuses for not taking care of my business. But the ultimate goal of all this is to live well. And my one last thing, this is one of my, and I've gone to this, why do we bother to do all this? And I think, people talk about having emotional sobriety, which is coming to a point, in my mind, it's coming to a point of maturity and comfort in my own skin and peace of mind. But what was in the grapevine in January 1958 says this: if we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependency and its consequent unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling liabilities. Then we can be set free to live in love. We may be then able to 12-step ourselves as well as others into emotional sobriety. And that's why we do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. So that brings us to the question and answer portion of our meeting tonight. Does anybody have any questions for Leslie?
Hi, Leslie. I'm Bridget. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bridget.
Thank you for doing this for the last several weeks, and you have a few more to go. Thank you for your sobriety. 31 years, or how many years do you have?
38.
Oh, dear.
38
God.
And change.
God bless you. Wow.
I was like almost an infant. No, I wasn't. I was in my 20s, though. And
well, at any rate, how do you know the guys that were drinking beer on the porch across the street weren't just a bunch of drunks and they couldn't get up and cut their own tree?
I guess I'm just saying. Well, you know, I guess I didn't know it, but that was like the sense I had. And, you know, whether it was really true, it seemed to me they were kind of pointing and laughing, but, you know, I could have been
maybe
wrong.
Maybe they were drunk. But anyway,
I could have just been feeling sorry for myself too, thinking, why don't these guys help me? I'm struggling here.
When you were talking about how we have to look inside of ourselves instead of talking about what everybody else is doing and complaining about everything, that was something that I too discovered when I came in the rooms. I thought I was going to come in here and learn how to not drink, but I'm learning how to live. And I wondered when did it dawn on you through your years of sobriety that you were going to have to look outward and look at what you needed to do as a recovering alcoholic to have defects removed or at least make an attempt?
Well, thank you. That's a great question. And when I was new, I had good sponsorship. I was sponsored by some strong women who gave me no quarter. First of all, you know, it was different, but I remember, I'll just tell you a story, okay? This was with the first husband, okay? And a lot of my defects, like I said, came out in my marriage encounters. And he and me were battling, and, you know, on and on. So I'm calling my sponsor, and I'm crying, you know, the usual, right, what you expect. I'm like less than 2 years sober, on and on. So she tells me to get out of bed and wash my face. And I said, but you don't understand, boo-hoo-hoo, blah-blah-blah. She says, get out of bed and wash your face. And he's such a this and that, and yada-da. And she said, listen, she said, you are not a victim here, you have a choice. She said, you could kill him if you're willing to sit it out in jail. Are you willing to sit it out in jail? And I said, well, no, I'm not. And she said, well, then get out of bed and wash your face and start to pull your act together, and then we'll talk. And that's just one. I was less than 2 years sober then, and that kind of began, like, I always have a choice. Do I want to pay the price of doing something different, or do I want to give up, you know, the cost of being in this situation? Because everything has a cost. And my first sponsor, she was a very, very smart woman. And, you know, I was, like I said, I was in my mid-20s. So love and relationships and all of that stuff was very, that's like where you're at that phase of life. And I was no different. And what she said was, you need to remember, she always called me hun, you need to remember this, hun. No one stays in any relationship or any situation unless they are getting something from it. Even if what they're getting from it is sick. And always remember that. And I've always remembered that. And I've always looked at, like, myself and my, you know, relationships, even my work life, you know, deciding what am I getting from it? Is it serving me? Is it worth the cost to me? and to evaluate things in that manner. So that was like from early on, I was raised by women who, they did not buy into the poor little you, oh boo-hoo-hoo, you were so damaged, traumatized, it was no, wake up, take a look, what are you choosing, what's it cost you, what are you willing to give up in order to have this? So it was really constant, it just like I had to stay sober and be willing to do that stuff, you know, and evaluate. But it's that benchmark has kind of always served me pretty well. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Hi, Jim, alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks, Leslie. Someone several years ago at a meeting interpreted a part of that seventh step prayer, which was really helpful to me. And every morning as I recite that seventh step prayer, I remember this person, what they said about this portion of the prayer. The portion of the prayer, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. How that portion was interpreted was what made a big difference for me. I just kind of wonder what your interpretation of that portion was.
Oh, that made a big difference to me, too. You know, when I was told that, suddenly it was, okay then, you know, so if I tend to be late, I guess that's kind of not in God's way, you know? So I guess I don't need to worry about that so much yet, so. I found that kind of freeing, and at least for the moment. But you know, as time goes on, then there's less and less excuse. But you know, really, God knows better than me. And I also, God, did I read this or talk about this to somebody? But you know, even. And or it's some in one of the meetings from the Drop the Rock book talking about God just uses our defects anyway. So I might think it's a defect, but God's, you know, God knows who I am and what I am, and if I'm willing, I can be made positive use of or play a part in a situation that turns out for the better anyway. So I found it kind of freeing and let me accept myself a little more to kind of strive to do better but not beat myself up so much for something that I had a hard time. So yeah, I guess kind of like you, you know. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. My question is, I've heard many times in the rooms, the only step you have to do correct is one. And, you know, after reviewing this, I read this before the meeting and thinking more about it, if you want to really get healthy, mind, body, and soul, you have to do this correctly or work on it until it becomes a habit. Do you agree or you want to expound on that?
Well, I think so. I think you're right. It depends on how happy and free I want to be. And if I am okay with, you know, see, for me in the end, it's about, can I look at myself in the mirror? How much comfort level do I have with lying to myself that I'm okay with, you know? Now, if I don't know, then I don't know. But if I know I'm just in this marriage because I don't want to shovel the snow, that's BS. That's wrong, you know? I think it is important, and again, at the most simple level, you know, because like those old timers when I was new would say, the man I was drank, the man I was will drink again, I have to change. So underneath all of that is still always that alcohol that is always out there waiting for me, you know, at one level or another, and the slide might be long and subtle or it could be fast and hard, but I think you know, it, how much do we want to get out of this? Do we want halfway, or do we want as much as possible? And that's up to everyone.
Thank you. And a side note on your tree trimming experience, how sober were you at that time?
I was like 13 years sober when I got that house. I was so proud of myself because I considered it one of my crowning achievements in my recovery, because I bought that house myself without a husband or a man to help me. I bought the place myself. And it was really, this might be a defective character, but I was divorcing, and I thought, wow, I can just tell him to get off of my property, you know? And this was mine, and that was that. And it wasn't, you got this from me or something. No, no, no. And truly, to the ability to gather those things is straight out of my sobriety and my recovery, thanks to God, AA, and everyone. But that's about one of my proudest accomplishments, was to own another home, bought myself, and that was big, you know, that's big. And I don't know, maybe that's my ego, I kind of don't care, but that was a long time coming. My second house is a little better than my first house. It's still not as good as if I'd have had the second income chipping in on, you know, making the mortgage, but it's mine. And so to me, that's very freeing. And if you had lived through my period of relationships, that's very important to me, that I have something for me. I tend to think, you know, if I might opine, I tend to think it's important for most women to have that level of personal autonomy, or know that they have the ability to do that if that's what has to be done. But I'm grateful, and I was like 13 years sober. I was 40. I turned 40, bought the house, moved in, and that was when that was. And yeah, I'd mow the lawn, I'd crank up the music, you know, I'd spend, I took a lot of joy in that house. So
if you had to do it differently, you know, I'm trying to tie it in with the step about humility. Would you find to humble yourself to go across the street and say, could you help me do this, because I'm just not tall enough?
Well, you know, I might have, but in that case, I didn't. And, you know, there's...
Today,
I would ask someone to help me. I would, you know, call a professional or ask for help.
That's a character defect of mine, too, is asking for help.
And that was also... See, and I was divorcing, and, you know, the mindset's all there, too, of these... Who knows, you know? And you know, Bridget makes a great point. This might have been my state of mind at that time. And as it did turn out, as a matter of fact, the one neighbor would always help me. And the other guy, he was just a nasty drunk. Seriously, he was. He was one of those drunk contractor type of guys. But the other one would, like, he was like a bundle of energy, and his wife would tell me, oh, he's just hyperactive. And I would come home and my lawn would be mowed. She said, that was Herb, like, he can't sit still, so he went over and mowed your lawn. It's like, okay then, you know, that's fine. And I would bake cookies or something. So, you know, I learned to, because of this and things like step seven, you know, that's another example of being a part of life, you know, just... You do something kind, I learned to reciprocate appropriately. I didn't know that stuff, you know, before. So, anybody else?
All right.
Okay, then.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.